You are listening to Studying Pixels, a podcast on game studies and video game culture. I'm Stefan, I'm a game studies scholar from Germany.
I'm Dan, a Japanese scholar from Texas.
And you can find us every Sunday on studyingpixels.com and wherever you get your podcasts. The brand new Super Mario movie is coming out on 5th of April, 2023. And so we're looking forward to that. It looks to be a promising and fun film. But instead of doing an episode about that, we thought, why not go back and review the infamous Super Mario Brothers film from 1993?
Well, I can come up with a lot of reasons why not.
Yeah.
Chief among them being this movie is I want to get into this really quickly. I have two things to say generally about this film. One, it was certainly ambitious. There was a lot of interesting visuals in it. I think it's difficult to adapt a video game even like The Last of Us, which is very story heavy. And then you look at a game like Super Mario Brothers and you go, where do we start? So I understand the undertaking was probably pretty difficult. The second thing I want to say is I hate this movie. This was awful.
Actually, I realized only when we internally agreed that we would do this as a like kind of joke episode, we would review the original Super Mario Brothers film. Only afterwards I then realized, damn it, that means I need to watch it. I don't want to watch this film again.
It was all fun and games until we had to sit down and actually try to find this thing.
Yeah.
Because it's been scrubbed from the internet, except for these archive sites. No streaming service carried it. Sounds like it didn't carry it in Germany either. So a VPN wouldn't help you.
Yeah, I think I saw it on Amazon Prime, but only in German. It was only available in the German dubbed version.
Which... Maybe would have improved it. I don't know. I'm not going to watch it again to figure out, but boy, oh boy. Yeah. So, I'm sure we'll have a lot to say about it, but I think we both are in agreement that this is a terrible, terrible, terrible film.
Yeah. It's an excellent foil to compare the new Super Mario film to, and to see how far we've actually come in making movie adaptations of video games. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk about why this original Super Mario Brothers film from 1993, why it failed, why it didn't manage to meet expectations. And we're going to talk about why it still managed to reach some kind of infamy, some kind of iconic pop culture status, because I assume that everyone is more or less aware that this movie existed in the early 90s. But before we go into that, let me briefly remind you that if you like this show and you want to help us make it happen to watch more terrible films, then you can do so by supporting us and joining Studying Pixels Plus. There you can find all of our episodes entirely ad-free, a lovely sticker if you subscribe to the $5 tier or higher, and all of our monthly plus episodes. Some of them are about how to study, how to research. Others are deep dives into video game culture or video game history. Definitely worth a listen. If you're curious about that, you can go to studyingpixels.com/plus to find out more.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The Now, first, we're going to look into why this original Super Mario Brothers film failed, why it didn't manage to become a blockbuster. A couple of reasons, but let's start at the beginning. Let's start in the process of production. Because this film was directed by Rocky Morton and Annabelle Jankel. They are a husband and wife director duo, you could say.
Which, and I should say, weirdly, they were like the creators of Max Headroom. Did you know that?
Yes, Max Headroom. That is this weird kind of, also like an iconic phenomenon, right?
Yeah, it was this thing on, I think MTV is where it started, where it was like, the idea was that he was an AI robot host. And so he looked kind of like a plasticine man. Actually, you know what? He looked like Koopa in this film. now that I think about it. And he would kind of glitch out and say, you know, next time on MTV or whatever. He was a host. And it was just an interesting countercultural movement. So that's where we're starting with this weird pair of people who... I don't know, Stefan, take it away.
Well, I think this is an interesting piece of information, though, because I know that with this Max Headroom character that this director duo had created, I know that they also did things like they hacked some kind of TV frequency once and like inserted clips of Max Headroom. And it's called like the Max Headroom incident.
That is really interesting. That wasn't them. It was some... We don't know who it was exactly. There's an idea of who it was, but it was somebody who took on the persona of Max Headroom.
And
they hacked into a TV, like a local, I think it was Chicago, a local TV station. So that, notice, I would like to talk about anything other than this film.
Yeah, but it is interesting that they created this, let's say, more a counter-cultural, more like subversive kind of character AI host figure.
Yeah.
And that they were also in the directing seat primarily for this Super Mario Brothers movie. It already indicates that this is not going to be like a conventional, or by today's standard, not a conventional adaptation of the video game text in some way. And it was produced by Roland Joffé. Joffé, he was at the time already a household name in the film business. He had won an Academy Award for Best Director twice, in 1984 and in 1986. And he obtained the license to make a Super Mario film. He basically proposed this idea to Nintendo to make a Super Mario film. And Nintendo, they were so confident that the Super Mario series as such would be just basically invincibly successful, that they gave Joffé largely free rein. As far as I'm aware, Nintendo was not really that actively involved in the process. They were, I've read about this a little bit, and they seemingly had more the attitude of like, let them do what they want. You know, we'll see it as a peculiarity. We'll see what they do and what comes of it. We're not getting too involved. So there was not this usual kind of strict creative control, what you would normally expect from Nintendo.
Well, and it's interesting too, because I know that this was in the news a lot about this new film, the new Super Mario Brothers movie, from Illumination Entertainment. It's the opposite, and I think it's because of this film where they gave Joffé and these directors free rein to kind of make this make this experience, and they clearly learned their lesson, and I think they've been over vigilant on this one. There were stories about, I think there was an initial screening that happened with maybe even Miyamoto himself, and there was a lot of notes that they had, things that needed to change, especially when you consider how far Super Mario has come since 1993. You can tell that they're a lot more precious with this IP than they were back then.
Yeah, the character of Super Mario himself is much more clearly developed than he was back in the day. So basically what the directors and producers started out with was really a very abstract source material. It's just these old Super Mario video games that don't have much of character development whatsoever. I mean, still Mario is still largely a, I would say, a an open space, basically an imaginative space that players can project their own personality into.
Mm.
But he's a little bit more refined in his aesthetics and his personality than he was at the time. And so it was really quite unclear in which direction it would go. We're going to go into detail on the exact direction that it turned out to be. But first, let's look at how the movie was received. Because as indicated by Wikipedia, that's where I found the most reliable numbers, it did not manage to basically cover its own budget. So the budget for this film was incredibly high. We're talking about 42 to 48 million US dollars. It was high in the sense that this is a video game adaptation.
Mm.
It's a film that's a little bit, that's not really, it doesn't really have the blockbuster promise attached to it.
Right. It's interesting to think about when this came out, because nowadays you would think, okay, obviously a game like Mario getting a movie, everybody knows about Mario. Even people who don't play it would probably go to see it, right? I think that's what Illumination is banking on, is that Mario is such a huge thing for people who play games, but also parents, family members. He's more Mickey Mouse now. People know who he is. But back then, you know, $40 million for this video game movie. This was back when I'm sure people were like, there's an annoying crack at video games in this movie where Luigi, John Leguizamo, says he knows how to like work a computer. He's like, yeah, because I sit on my butt and play video games all day. That line is how I think the general public saw video games at the time. So there wasn't going to be a huge audience for this because it was a novelty. It was a silly thing.
Yes, it was catering towards these primarily, I would say, teenage boys who they assume are the primary audience for Super Mario and or for video games in general. And this budget was presumably so high, 42 million at least, because they had to pay a lot of money for special effects. There's a lot of animatronics and special effects in this film. And of course, also for the cast, because we're talking about really high profile actors that appear in this film. I would say probably most notably is Dennis Hopper, who plays Koopa, King Koopa in the film. So the equivalent of Bowser, which is a very unusual role for Dennis Hopper.
I want to get into this because this is maybe the one, we can talk about this later maybe, but this is the one interesting aspect of this movie that I actually genuinely find to be something of kind of prescient import. He's Trump, right? He's just Trump. He's like a real estate loser. He orders a pizza at one point. I mean, this was at the time when Trump was kind of outside of his popularity from the 80s, and he was starting to shill for fast food places in the early 90s. And he looks like him. He dresses like him. He's, you know, that's the one like little interesting nugget that they decided to make Koopa Trump in 1993.
Yeah, you might be very well on point there. I hadn't thought about it simply because in Germany, or at least for me, I wasn't consciously aware of the existence of Donald Trump before started running for president.
Yeah.
So I've maybe seen some brief clips, but wasn't really aware of this, of who this guy was. But of course, he had a much bigger role in the U.S. and in U.S. American culture for many years. So Dennis Hopper's interpretation of King Koopa would be, I guess, a very rich man who owns real estate.
Yeah, in
Manhattan.
Yeah.
Yes. And he basically protrudes into politics and becomes the leader of this whole alternate dimension, you could say. This alternate dimension where he also does something that, you know, Donald Trump could be attributed to Donald Trump as well.
Yeah.
He kind of de-evolves his subjects into Koopas, who then have like a shrink head and they're like dinosaur human beings. They basically lose their intelligence entirely.
Yeah, they become. Yeah, this is again, I do want to put a pin in it because we always try to find the good in things. Right. I will say that surprisingly prescient. this look at Koopa. And I think that Dennis Hopper I think you were going to go into this, Dennis Hopper, Bob Hoskins, John Leguizamo, there's real talent in this film. And I think that it's a testament to Dennis Hopper's consummate professionalism that I think he was only supposed to be there for a few months or something, and it turned into like 18 months of filming, which resulted in him screaming at these at this director pair. And I mean, he's kind of playing it tongue in cheek, but the absolute talent of being able to stick with this and try to give a performance is pretty commendable on Dennis Hopper. So kudos to Mr. Hopper.
It is also true that the performances of the actors themselves are not necessarily in themselves bad. Mm-mm. Because Dennis Hopper in this film, I think you can clearly tell that he does give his all to make King Koopa a despicable megalomaniac, basically directly out of a comic book. And he does that with great dedication.
He does.
And the same applies to Bob Hoskins, who plays Mario, and John Leguizamo. I don't know whether I mispronounced the name. I apologize.
No, you got it.
For doing so. Okay. I'm not going to repeat it because now it's on record and now I got it right. I'm never going to say that name again. So he plays Luigi. And the pair of Mario and Luigi also have this kind of dynamic going for them. So you could say that the acting itself was not necessarily a problem. Still, even though this tremendous budget was invested into, you know, special effects, animatronics, and a really high-profile cast, the movie made only $38.9 million. So they basically lost quite some money, a couple of million on this film. And that was, of course, a big disappointment. Now, the thing is, though, that what's even worse is the fact that in hindsight, even the people that contributed to making this film really don't like it. I found a quote in an interview. Bob Hoskins, who plays Mario in this film, he spoke with The Guardian in 2007, and they asked him what the worst thing was that he ever did, and he responds as follows. I want to, a brief disclaimer, there are going to be some curse words in here that we don't usually use on this show, but I'm just going to read it out as he said it. So he said, "The worst thing I ever did, Super Mario Brothers. It was a fucking nightmare. The whole experience was a nightmare. It had a husband and wife team directing whose arrogance had been mistaken for talent. After so many weeks, their own agent told them to get off the set. Fucking nightmare, fucking idiots." End quote.
Rest in peace, Bob Hoskins, you absolute legend.
That is, he doesn't mince words, does he?
No, and at that time in 2007, I mean, Bob Hoskins is a incredible character actor. My favorite performance is Who Framed Roger Rabbit, where he plays Eddie Valiant. And I think it should be noted that that was a film where he was acting against nothing, or he was acting against a contraption that was meant to stand in for what would eventually be the animation that they would put in, which at the time was incredible. Who Framed Roger Rabbit, great film. He did that for months, and this movie broke him. He was able to withstand acting against nothing, taking on good faith that everything would turn out okay in the animation edit. And Super Mario Brothers is the one that he regrets. So, good Lord.
It is also striking that normally in the film business, people don't really criticize the people that they worked with to such an extent.
Yeah.
I mean, with such explicit words. Normally, people who are a bit dissatisfied or not that proud of something that they've done, they would say like, that was probably like a weak point in my career and so on. I'm still, you know, very grateful for the entire time with the team and stuff like that. You know, that's how you have corporate speech normally. But in this case, this is really like a straightforward insult. There's clearly like, it's pure disgust for this time, for this film.
Well, one thing that I found while looking up trivia for this film was that, because you mentioned that, so Bob Hoskins and John Leguizamo as the Super Mario Brothers, I do think they're good performances. It's just an awful, awful script. But Bob Hoskins is really kind of warm as Mario in a way that's fun, I think, where he clearly loves his brother and he's trying to help him. And he's putting a lot of humanity into this role that, as you were saying, Stefan, wasn't clearly defined from the games yet, right? And so he's a little rough around the edges, this Mario, because he's like a back end of middle-aged Brooklyn plumber who has no money. So he's a little more edgy. I think at one point he says, I'm going to break all their bones and then kill them.
Oh, yes. So,
yeah, that's a little tough for Mario. But he and Luigi, I think, definitely have some chemistry. And I think that's probably because Bob Hoskins and John Leguizamo felt like they were war buddies in this film. And they were getting drunk all the time just to make it through the day. And I think they probably formed a nice little bond there. So maybe some good came out of this horrible experience for Hoskins.
I actually just realized we haven't even spoken about what the story is at all. We just kind of presumed that people would know what the storyline of this film is, but we can briefly assemble it in its rough stretches. So basically, Mario and Luigi are actually, as you said, broke, washed out plumbers, plumbing brothers, and they are located in Manhattan where there are mysterious abductions going on, like women are abducted.
Yep.
And it turns out that these abductions are actually related to King Koopa in an alternative dimension, who's looking for Daisy. Daisy, who in this film is an archaeologist who studies dinosaur bones. So she's not a princess at all, at least not in this dimension.
Mm.
And Daisy, she has a rock around pendant. Her neck, like a necklace, a pendant. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, a mysterious rock. And Koopa wants her and the rock in order to merge dimensions so that he can become the king of both worlds.
Yeah, that's the long and the short of it. And there's a lot of insufferable stuff in between. But yeah, it's this idea that 65 million years ago, the meteorite that destroyed the dinosaurs didn't actually destroy them. It just sent them to a different dimension, and where they evolved kind of parallel to humans. But that world is also, because of the meteor, I think, it's like a desert except for Dino Hatton, the like just few blocks that King Koopa rules over. And yeah, it's, I mean, I guess fair play to the screenwriter to try to make a cohesive narrative, but I don't know. Like it just seems like a lot of fluff and a lot of leaps to take to kind of get to the point where it's just Mario and Luigi jumping around.
Yes. Just trying to save Daisy, because Daisy is then abducted and they are following her into this alternative dimension. And then their goal is obviously to free her and a bunch of other women that have been kidnapped. And it goes really off the rails from there, though. Like, we're talking about like ominous slime, fungal slime creatures. And we're talking about both of them being imprisoned in a kind of like, in a very kind of dystopian. Yeah, in a kennel. They find themselves in a very dystopian environment. And ultimately, they manage, of course, they manage after a bit of back and forth to rescue the princess and to, I think they turn King Koopa into an old glob that just simply splashes on the floor. They de-evolve him before he's been an sentient being or something.
Yeah, and I think that there is kind of setup for that. So they are following Robert McKee's story in some way here, where when King Koopa is explaining the de-evolution machine and the de-evolution gun, he says, okay, well, it's been 65 million years and we've all evolved to the point where we are. So when I use this machine on people, I can either make them dumb Goombas, like you were saying, Stefan, like these guys with, they're like 9 feet tall with really tiny heads that are stupid and malleable. Or I can revert the king of this world to the fungus that's all around the city, like idea evolve him to the point where he's just fungus. And that's why it's technically the quote mushroom kingdom. And yeah, it's, and so eventually the way that they beat Koopa is that they de-evolve him to like a single celled organism, I think is the idea. Cause they mentioned that at some point, they just turn him into goo, like primordial ooze.
May I briefly say that this entire fungal theme revolving around this film, there's basically in this dystopian alternate dimension, there is fungus growing all over the place and it's like just sludge that's everywhere, like almost like dried up sludge. The thing is that I understand that there's a narrative point to that, but the entire film is kind of a little bit disgusting because of it. It has this kind of, it has a kind of Cronenberg aesthetic to it. A little bit of, it's not quite body horror because it's not as explicit as that, but it is like constantly touching these like globby fungus stretches.
There's a lot of goo and what looks like phlegm and snot. It's just very, yeah, it's a sticky movie.
Yeah, it's a very sticky film indeed. Yeah. It is. And the thing is that if you're in a situation that you say, I love this film so much that I want to watch even more of it, and this is the last piece of information on this, you know, production and distribution. Mm. In 2021, they actually discovered an extended cut of the film that was stored on an old VHS tape. And it's a bit like the director's cut because it was made by Morten Jankel, by the original directors of the film. That's why they refer to it as the Morten Jankel cut. It adds 20 minutes to the ordeal. It's not anything in particular that's substantial. It's just that it extends some sequences. There's some additional stuff added in, a bit more padding than there already is. It was never properly released. There was apparently some kind of, or supposedly a kind of debate around whether it should be released, whether they should maybe, or they may have prepared it for a Blu-ray release. But that never happened. So this Morten Jankel cut, it was just leaked on the internet, and that's pretty much it. Nobody really cares about it, I think.
I don't think that it would... Here's the thing. So this movie's not... It's not, like, illogical in the sense that you can't follow what's happening. Because a lot of bad movies, you just don't understand what's going on from point A to point B. This movie is pretty clear because they talk about it a lot, what they're doing and why they're doing it. So the extra 20 minutes wouldn't clear anything up. It would just be 20 minutes of more of this surreal, sticky, weird world that I can't imagine anybody would get any enjoyment out of.
I must say that this surrealism, the dystopian tone, and this, the stickiness of the film, those are the key contributing factors why I think it doesn't work as a Super Mario adaptation, because it moves too far away from the source material. Like, we see something, currently we see the adaptation of The Last of Us by HBO, and we can see that this is almost a one-to-one adaptation of the source material. Mm. Now, in this case, it is completely the opposite. The film has, except for some references and some aesthetic cues, it hasn't got that much to do with what you would normally imagine as a Super Mario film. Because, you know, Mario himself, we mentioned this already, he works as an abstract character, he works as an avatar, but if you see him as a kind of broke, vulgar plumber, then he's not a bad character. Like, Hoskins, it doesn't play the role in a poor manner or something. It does make sense. It's a character that works, but it just doesn't feel quite like this is actually Mario, the Mario that we know and love from the games, you know?
You know what it feels like? Remember in the late 2000s on YouTube and other, like, video sharing websites, there was this kind of glut of what if blank but gritty and real kind of videos, where it was like, what if Pokemon was actually like in the real world, and it was like dog fighting, and, you know, there's like a Mortal Kombat series that was like, what if we took all of the fantasy out of Mortal Kombat, and a character like Baraka is just like a surgeon who went crazy and gave himself knives for hands or whatever they did in that show. This adaptation of it kind of feels like that, where it's like, what if Mario were, you know, he's down on his luck and he's just trying to make it in Brooklyn and his brother isn't listening to him. And, you know, it's all this kind of weird, not melodrama, but just angst for no reason. I guess at the time in 1993, we didn't really know Mario as we do now. I think probably Super Mario 64 was probably the game that really, when Charles Martinet's voice was added to it, kind of made him the more kind of Mickey Mouse character that we know him as. But it's just so jarring to see him as, you know, like a guy from a Goodfellas movie.
It's an interesting adaptation of the character, because it's too edgy to be family friendly. Normally, you would expect some kind of family friendly movie. The new Super Mario movie that we're going to get is probably going to be very much a family movie, something you can watch with your children on Christmas. Everything's fine and well. Now, this one is not. It's dark and gritty in some ways, but it's also not dark and gritty in a way that it would be a serious film. It's more like it's a dystopian action comedy, you could maybe say.
Yeah.
And it doesn't. It keeps this kind of middle ground. It never goes too far into the extreme on either side, but that also gets it stuck. It's not family friendly enough so you could, you know, harmlessly send a 6-year-old in it. But unfortunately, it's also not sophisticated enough to intrigue maybe more adult audiences.
Yeah, it's very tonally dissonant, I would say, for a video
dissonance,
game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dissonance is a really good word for this film, because I felt like they established the entire world as being a gritty dystopia by this kind of almost, you know, fascist / capitalist megalomaniac. And then it's the next couple of sequences are then just basically a fun roller coaster ride where they slide on a mattress through a plumbing tube and they're like, what?
And the music that plays in that scene, I was like, my mouth was open. The whiplash of that. Yeah, just moments like that. Because on the flip side, you have the, there's the mattress down the roller coaster kind of tube scene, which is ridiculous. And then you have, earlier, there's a scene where they kind of commandeer a police car and they're having a chase, like, and that felt more like it was part of this kind of gritty world in a way that felt like, okay, I don't know if this is like a Mario scene, but this is a interesting scene. They're trying to get away from people. You know, they nearly fall off a cliff. Like, okay, that's something. But then just the tonal whiplash of going from that to a bunch of 9 foot tall Goombas dancing in an elevator because Luigi intuits, because everyone likes to dance, that he's just going to rock them back and forth and that'll distract them. The whole time you're like, how did anyone come up with this moment and think that's how we'll get them out of this? It was...
Well, the thing is though, this weird mixture, I found it insufficiently entertaining to be a good movie. But instead, I found it more, I must say, I found it annoying, unfortunately. I don't like to say this usually about films, because I know that there are people who enjoy such things. But the movie is, in many ways, chaotic. And it's a very loud, it's a very noisy film. There's lots of screaming going on. And I was constantly turning down the volume, because there's so many sequences where for minutes on end, all you hear is just...
Yeah, it is.
I thought, oh God, why won't you stop? It's in the middle of the night. I don't want to wake my neighbors, you know?
I know. Oh my God, yes. Loud and annoying. It's really good. Because the patter of dialogue is insulting. Where, like, somebody will say things. I wish I wrote them down, because they were so jarring to me that I couldn't believe that I was hearing them in a film. Like certain things that like Daisy would say, or Luigi was especially a big culprit of this, where they would just spurt these non sequiturs and then the scene would end and it would be like, okay, now on to the next loud, annoying thing. And it was, you couldn't put two and two together with how the writer thought that would go in that scene. So it's a lot of just who knows what was cut to make it make sense as much as it does. But it was I did a lot of temple rubbing through this film.
Yeah. Well, now we've pointed out some very crucial flaws of this film, which might very well explain why the film failed to be appreciated by the audience as well as the people that were involved in making it. Let's take a brief break, and then we're going to talk about why it still managed to become some form of iconic.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
And we are back talking about the original Super Mario film from 1993. And now that we have established why this film is really not very nice, neither to watch, nor was it nice to make and to participate in it. But now we still have to ponder why it became as culturally iconic as it has seemingly become.
Yes, and I think I just want to launch us because obviously Miyamoto looms large in Super Mario, of course. And you may be asking, what did he think of the movie? Well, I have a quote here where he says, "I think that they tried very hard, and in the end, it was a very fun project that they put a lot of effort into. The one thing that I still have some regrets about is that the movie may have tried to get a little too close to what the Mario Brothers video games were. And in that sense, it became a movie that was about a video game rather than being an entertaining movie in and of itself." And that quote says to me, he has not seen the movie.
I thought that quote says to me that he's trying to be very polite and cautiously saying, it's actually not that good.
Well, there's a lot of language in that quote that distances Mario from the movie.
Yes.
And I think he's very strategic about it, ever confidently kind of remaining the salary man in the Nintendo world, towing the company line. But yeah, I just thought compared to Bob Hoskins' quote, that's a pretty mellow reading of the film.
But I don't understand how Miyamoto would come to the assessment that it's too much like the games, because it's actually very far from, I mean, it incorporates some material and like the key principle of the games, but aesthetically, the narrative, the characters, it's all quite far from not only the games as a source material, but also what presumably many people, including myself, have imagined, how they have filled the gaps in between the characters, for example.
If I'm being charitable, I think my read on that would probably be something that we would critique movies today of doing, which is just referencing things instead of telling a story, because there are a lot of, so there's a lot of kind of video game noises that play in the game. There's the ba-bomb. There's names like Iggy and Spike and Big Bertha. Like there's
Toad.
All of these. Toad. Yep.
Who's, I think, just like a fellow prisoner who appears, I think.
He's like a dissident. Like a punk, kind of.
Yeah, he's like a punk. He plays the harmonica. He's like, woo, or
something. And so he gets turned into a Goomba, but then he helps out Mario and Luigi and Daisy. So these names are in it. So maybe what Miyamoto meant was they felt beholden to making those references or putting things like that in instead of telling a narrative, which I could see also.
It could have well been just a Ghostbusters movie or something along those lines.
Yeah, it kind of feels, yeah, the big kind of supernatural New York kind of stuff. Yeah, there's, I don't know. I think that, as you were saying, where it kind of rides the line between too gritty and too family friendly, you know, Ghostbusters, the tone of that film, that would have been good for this. Like, just a couple of schlubs that are trying to make their way in the world and they get sucked into this crazy story. Like, you could have done it if you didn't feel like you had to have your foot in the video game world too. But then the question is, why make it?
then you have to put Bill Murray in the seat. And he's just like, he's just walking around on set. He himself is not even taking the movie seriously.
Uh-uh.
And suddenly it's great. Suddenly it's fantastic somehow.
Bill Murray as Koopa would have been funny. That would have been something else. Yeah.
Well, it was also, to be fair, and that's part of the reason why it might have become kind of iconic, at least to the degree that everyone is aware of it. Maybe some people have seen it at some point in their life. Is that it was the first major film adaptation of a video game. It was not like, there was this phase afterwards where lots of video games were adapted in like absurd ways, sometimes more, sometimes less successful. Like there was Mortal Kombat in 1995, which I remember watching when I was way too young to do so, or Resident Evil, the original Resident Evil film from 2002. All of these films, they were kind of inspired by the approach that the Super Mario movie took, which is not really being a one-to-one adaptation of the source material, but rather taking the source material and making it into a film as they might have expected one to be popular in the late 90s.
That's such a good point, because it really did set the bar for take some elements of the game, but then tell your own story with it. Because Resident Evil is such a great example, in that there's some shots, there's some names, there's some concepts that are from the games, but realistically it didn't need to be a Resident Evil movie. Yeah. I think Mortal Kombat, almost similarly, like all the characters are there and there's a lot of good performances in that 1995 movie. Like Johnny Cage is hilarious, I think. But it could have just been Supernatural tournament movie, you know, it just kind of slapped a Mortal Kombat skin on it, which is what a lot of movies did after this Super Mario Brothers movie.
I think it was the attempt to capitalize on this at the time, kind of surprising success, the surprising economic success of video games, popularity of the medium, without having a proper understanding of what the medium actually was. And so the film adaptations, they would be films. They would just be films that have, as you said, I think this is very apt, a skin, like a label of the video game attached. They've used a logo, they use names for characters and so on, but they're not really dedicated to the source material, because I think the sense at the time was that, well, it just doesn't translate well. You can't make a Resident Evil film that, in the way that the Last of Us series now adapts the Last of Us, that would be incredibly boring to watch. And I think that's kind of the sentiment that basically propelled many creators at the time to just run with the license and to do something that makes sense in the world of film, but not really makes much sense for video games.
And there's, I think, obviously there's an evolution of game to film adaptations. I think of the first Silent Hill film. I think it's not a good adaptation of the story, but I think aesthetically and tonally, it is a good adaptation.
Yeah.
And I think that eventually movies started to do that, where they would maybe tell their own story, but the feeling was very similar. And I think that's what led to things like The Last of Us and maybe this new Super Mario Brothers movie, where it's like, that feels like a Mario story. And I think that's the key, because as you said, they just made films because they didn't understand or respect the medium of video games. And they thought, oh, we'll elevate this by making it a movie. I think that was kind of the feeling. And you definitely get that in the Super Mario Brothers movie from 93.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, I know people who really enjoy Silent Hill and who are actually quite committed to this Silent Hill concept, or the Silent Hill franchise, I'm going to say, without ever having played the game. But because of these movies, because the movies were genuinely interesting films. They were they were well-made horror films, and they adapted the specific tonality that many people who were not familiar with the games did not know. And for them, it was like a first, this kind of like foggy town with a mine that's on fire below and this rain of ash.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a new aesthetic impulse that comes from video games. So I would also agree that that was the kind of time that was probably, when was that, the late 2000s?
I think the first one was 05, I think.
05?
Yeah.
Okay, 2005. That might have been the point when it slowly started shifting. And yeah, by now, of course, and this is to be respected, the Super Mario Brothers movie, that they were treading new ground. There was no path laid out for them how to do an adaptation, whereas nowadays, when HBO produces The Last of Us, they've got so much of reference material, so many learnings that creators have had in the past from adapting video games, that, of course, the way the directionality is a little bit more clear.
Would you say then that a big contributor to the kind of longevity that this movie has had, even though it's nowhere to be found on streaming, you basically have to go to a secondhand video store to find a DVD of it. Do you think that it's because A, it's Mario, and B, it was the first of its kind, so that it's kind of the bar to which all other adaptations are compared, for better or worse?
That, yes. And also, I think because of the very lack in quality control from the side of Nintendo, because usually everything we get that is Nintendo themed has this strict quality control. They don't give their license away easily. And in this is one of the very few, if not the only example, probably one of the very few. I think there are presumably others as well. One of the very few examples where you could see what might happen if Nintendo just says, okay, here's our most beloved mascot, Super Mario. Just do with it.
Go for it.
Want to make a slime globby monster? Want to make Yoshi into an actual animatronic dinosaur? Go ahead, you know?
He's not even green. Whatever. I think that's absolutely something that they learned from this. And I want to point out, too, the next adaptation of a Nintendo property that was made was in 2019, 26 years later. It was Detective Pikachu, which I think is a good movie. I think it's pretty fun.
Yeah.
And I think probably because the directive to the Pokemon company was, you need to be involved in this as much as possible. Do not let, you know, as much as I respect the art of directing, right? There are certain franchises where you say, we need to rein you in on this because this is a very particular IP that we have very particular rules for. So I think they did a good job in that. But it took nearly 30 years before they felt comfortable doing something.
Imagine something like Detective Pikachu would be with this kind of lack in quality control, where just some director would just be like, look, I imagine Ash to be this kind of, you know, washed out heroin addict. and he's trying to get out of his misery by making animals fight each other.
Where's the fun and whimsy in that? Oh, it's not there. Okay. Well,
you want to maybe hold off on that idea.
But it's so true, because I feel maybe we got all that out of our system with all of the Funny or Die type like parody videos that came out in the late 2000s, mid 2010s, where it's like, all right, yep, we get it. It would be pretty interesting if it was all gritty and realistic, but hey, we've had a pretty interesting example of that in the 1993 Super Mario Brothers movie, and it's never worked once. So
yes, I'm glad actually that they now find a new tonality where they realize that, let's try and give people the kind of joy and comfort and the sincerity that they get from the video games. Let's take that as a key principle to the film. Whether the character is a little bit adapted in some way, whether it looks exactly like it, or maybe there's some small changes, that doesn't matter all that much. The tonality is key. People enjoy Mario. It's a lighthearted, fun experience, just like the Sonic films, which also were quite good. They are all about, you know, like over-the-top action and absurd villain, very gracefully played by Jim Carrey. An excellent choice, where you say, that's exactly the tonality that we expect from Sonic.
I think that hits on it. And, you know, there, I guess it may have just been the 90s because there was a lot of advertising that was for boys that was gross and it was shocking and, you know, this ain't your dad's whatever and no girls allowed kind of stuff. And I think that bred, first of all, a lot of the problems that we see today in video game culture, but then also I think it bred a kind of cynicism where it was like these games are toys for children, specifically like gross boys. And so we can't make, you know, film is a higher art form. So if we make a movie out of it, we have to be tongue in cheek and we have to be winking all the time. And it's almost like we're making this with the understanding that it's silly or it's frivolous. And I think that's so strange to me because a predecessor to this film that was not about an adaptation, it wasn't an adaptation of a video game, but it was about Nintendo, was the film The Wizard. Have you ever seen that, Stefan?
No, I haven't.
So The Wizard came out in 1989 and it had Fred Savage in it. And it was a story about a couple of kids who had gone through a lot of trauma in their early life. And one kid in particular, I think he's kind of meant to be autistic in it. He's the wizard and he's like a genius at video games. And so it's a trip to the movie's about going to California to participate in the Nintendo World Championship. But really, it's about kind of using video games as a tool to become closer with one another. And it was really ahead of its time in the sense of, yes, it was kind of an advertisement for Nintendo, but the heart of it was this is a family that's kind of communicating to each other through games. And it's just weird to me that came out and was the first kind of quote video game movie. And then we had 15, 20 years of just cynicism and this is silly and it's not worth anything.
Yeah. Now that you tell me the story about the wizard, I do immediately feel more drawn to it because I think I've mentioned this before on the show that a quintessential video game experience for me was actually playing Super Mario World with my family, with my mother. And we were like, you know, always like Mario and Luigi, and one was getting lives to help the other in a difficult level. And it was like, oh, did you defeat this boss? Wow, cool, show me, and so on. It was a really unifying and kind of relaxing, cozy, heartfelt experience. And of course, in stark contrast to the darkness, the grittiness, the dystopian fiction that we see in a film such as the Super Mario Brothers film, I also wonder whether, to a certain degree, campy reception might be a part of why the film became so iconic. Because campy reception, that basically just means that you're enjoying the way in which something is terrible. You watch a film because you know that film is actually awful. It's very terribly made, but you can still enjoy it because it's so terrible. And I think there is a little bit of that campy reception involved as well. There's a curiosity. This is the reason for why we decided to do this episode.
Yeah.
Because we're just curious about how terrible the film is and harping on it for its silliness, basically.
I think that's right, because people, I mean, myself included, love bad movies. I used to do this. I don't do it as frequently because I don't have as many people living near me, but I used to do bad movie parties with people, you know, and we'd watch The Room and Birdemic and Manos, The Hands of Fate, all these classic horrible films. But I think that there is a campiness factor in it that's very specific because it's a very niche cultural artifact where it's like, hey, this is what kind of spawned all of the video game movie discourse. So let's go back and watch it. And I think that there's definitely some silliness in it. Dennis Hopper is chewing all the scenery in every scene he's in. He is over the top. He is, he's expressing not wanting to be there by almost like sabotaging the film. And that's kind of worth it. Cause like there's a scene when he is just up to his neck in mud
Yeah.
And I was just the whole time laughing, thinking, how long was that shoot for that scene? How many days was Dennis Hopper up to his neck in mud and just furious at these two idiot directors? That's where a lot of the enjoyment comes from, I think.
Yeah, and the mud didn't even play any kind of significance in the film. He could have just sat in a chair or on a couch. Instead, they had to put him in a mud bath for that scene.
It was actually antithetical to his whole weird quirk that he had, because he's like a germaphobe for some reason, and he's always washing his hands and wiping things down, and then you just see him up to his neck in mud, and as if the filmmakers realized, oh, that's a little dissonant with what we've done this whole movie, he has this ridiculous line where he says, I love mud because it's dirty, but also clean.
Yeah. Oh, man. And reviewing this film, it just gets worse in my memory. But the thing is that when we talk about camp, it's not deliberately campy. It's not like Sharknado, for example, where it's just where they just say, we're going to make a film that's all about just people laughing at how stupid the film is. It's not that. It's also not in itself a terrible film. It is an I would say, okay film. It's something that I wouldn't recommend watching. Mm-hmm. It's just not, it's not good enough to be enjoyed for that. And it's also not bad enough to be enjoyed for that.
If it wasn't for the Mario name on it, this would be just another forgotten B movie from the late 80s, early 90s.
Probably, yes.
Yeah.
Probably. Well, one thing that we have to mention at the end here to conclude the conversation is that they did also see a kind of potential in it. So at the very end of the film, the Mario brothers are back in the original dimension. The world has been saved. King Koopa has been dissolved into
goo.
I don't know. Goo, yes. And everything's fine. Daisy, however, she stays behind in the alternate dimension. And then there's a scene where the Mario brothers are at home waiting for a new job.
They're having a pasta.
Yes, they're having some pasta, as they often do. And suddenly, Daisy barges through the door, and she's like in an all like military outfit, and she's got like a shotgun in her hand, and she's like, guys, you have to come with me. You wouldn't believe what happened. And Mario is just like, oh, I believe it. Let's go. And they make off for another adventure. The interesting thing is that what they kind of did here is they made Daisy a much more active character than she was in the video game series at the time, because they gave her a shotgun or like whatever kind of gun that was. I didn't see it, went back pretty quickly. But she was clearly in a kind of military conflict here.
It's interesting because that, for the bulk of the movie, she is imprisoned, similar to the princesses in the Mario games. And then they did give her a lot of agency at the end of it for this little glimpse of, oh, maybe she's going to be... Because I will say this, this movie, interestingly, is more like Luigi's story than it is Mario's, because he's the one who falls in love with Daisy. He's the one who's got like a character arc. Mario is just kind of there to guide him at certain points and be his older brother. So it did seem like they were setting up for, okay, like this was the focus on Luigi. The next one would be focused on Daisy and maybe she would be more active. But, you know, what did you say? It was $38 million on a $42 million budget. So that was not going to happen.
Yeah, there's no sequel of this film. I wonder why. But the thing is that they did see more potential in Daisy than the original creators of Mario have for a long time. And I did find that interesting, that reversal of roles, the potentiality, just simply the idea of imagine a sequel to this film where Daisy would be the protagonist. I would have found that interesting. Well, I don't think it would have been a successful film, not at all. I mean, not with the same kind of setup that they had for the first one.
No.
So I'm glad that they didn't do a sequel. But it's an interesting way to end the film, to go in this completely different direction. This was before the kind of debates around video games about the empowerment of female characters and so on. And they just did that because it felt right to them. So I think they were onto something there.
Yeah, and I think there's some connective tissue. I mean, granted, the games have also done this with making Peach more of a character with agency. Specifically, I'm thinking of the end of Super Mario Odyssey, where she just rejects both Mario and Bowser in a very funny way. It does seem from the trailers for this new film that she's going to be much more active, and maybe she'll get kidnapped. But I think the way that it looks is almost like Luigi's the one who's in trouble, and Mario will have to work with Peach to go and save him, which I think will be pretty fun.
Shall we do an episode about this new film at some point? We probably don't have to do it directly when it comes out, since we just spoke about Super Mario film for quite a while.
For an hour.
Already. Yes. But I think once we've both seen it, maybe we could just discuss and we could see all of the things that the new Super Mario film did that probably are way better than the original Super Mario film from 1993.
I totally look forward to it. And I think I'm happy to say that I've put a tombstone on the Super Mario Brothers 1993 film. No more.
Well, thank you so very much for listening. If you wish to, you can submit your thoughts and questions to studyingpixels.com/contact if you have any, if you have enjoyed the film as much as we have. But please do go ahead and enjoy the new Super Mario film. You know that if you want to support us and get Studying Pixels Plus, you can do that by going to studyingpixels.com/plus, and we will talk again next week. See you then.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.